we have the Association of Chartered Certified Accountants, it must be. Is that right? Mr. Nicholas van Beek, Technical Support Executive, and Ms. Cindy Parvis, Head of Business Regulations in South Africa. Right, can you proceed?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Honourable members, different state departments and other stakeholders, thank you very much for the opportunity to present our submission to you. We already submitted a written submission to you, and then I made a very brief summary on a PowerPoint slide, just to highlight what is in our written submission. Our submission will be limited to financial reporting elements of the Act affecting financial reporting and also reporting on financial statements. We wish to express our appreciation to the DTI for the engagement with the business community since 2004, and this is a very important point. The Companies Act has already been worked through and shared and discussed since 2004, and hence our I suppose support and request that the Act be implemented as soon as possible. The DTI throughout this period showed a commitment to clear and concise legislation, and we wish to congratulate them on that. And our submission is in two parts, general comments and then comments on specific sections. As a summary of what we're trying to relate to the honourable members, I've made these few slides. It's important to remember when considering the amendments that this Act is both for big and small companies. It incorporates all of the elements, all of the types of companies, including closed corporations and companies. So it's an Act for big and small companies. And this means minimum requirements for all companies, as detailed in the Act, but then via the use of alterable and unalterable provisions, selective application of other sections based on public interest and company activity. And this is a core principle of the Companies Act. Not everything in the Act applies to all companies, which is the correct approach. We call this differential legislation. It then flows through to financial reporting, called differential financial reporting, and hence this principle on which the Act is drafted as a combination of two statutes provides for the independent review as an alternative to the audit, and also then, if you take the argument further, demands a different regulatory model, if you will, for the independent review. And then it also provides for audit exemption. It's important, some previous presenters did talk about the financial crisis. We need to remember that this crisis largely was limited to international banks, and the argument that therefore not flow that because certain big industries did horrible things, all companies should now suddenly be audited or regulated in a certain manner. And the principle is audit is for the public interest. So in many places in the Companies Act, the public interest concept does not apply to all companies. It specifies both in the Act and the draft regulations that public interest only attaches to certain types of companies, depending on what they do, their activity, and dependent upon their size. So we must guard against overburdening the SME sector. The second principle is there's a move away from the audit as the sole means of protecting the public. The Act provides much more sophisticated approach to public protection. We'll be discussing this in much more detail, and hence when you consider the proposed amendments, you need to consider the holistic approach that's embedded within the Companies Act when considering adding additional measures of protection and regulation, because there is already a lot within the company itself, the Companies Act itself. There's a new emphasis on preparers of financial statements. This is a move away from our Companies Act and CC Act was drafted in the past with its reliance on auditors and accounting officers. The emphasis now on the person that prepares the financial statement. So what, in our opinion, the drafters did was to take the focus from auditing and place it on how accounting records should be kept. Indeed, the provisions for accounting records has been strengthened tremendously, and that in itself will provide comfort to investors and banks and credit providers. And the independent review, in our mind, improves the accounting officer regime. It's something to note. South Africa has a two-tiered reporting system for 20 years now already. Accounting officers require the appointment of of the Close Corporation Act requires the appointment of an accounting officer. That person has been performing reporting function for CCs since 1984, and we think that system worked acceptable. It needs to be strengthened, and I suggest this is what the independent review seeks to do. All right, so our general comments. The fundamentals of the Companies Act 2008 is to strengthen entrepreneurship. Enterprise development is to promote simplification, reducing costs, increasing flexibility in the design of companies, and the Company Act does achieve this by allowing owners of the company to use the memorandum of incorporation to adapt the company form to best suit their needs. So this is a wonderful piece of innovation in our legislation. There's enhanced transparency and standards of governance and important concept of international harmonization. The drafting framework, taking those principles further, achieves then there's a requirement in the Act which says that it has to be aligned with the Constitution and Bill of Rights. It's a unitary statute incorporating both the Companies Act and the CC Act. That's very important to remember. So whatever the CC did for SME companies, the new Act must reflect, and hence the introduction of audit exemption, and we suggest the independent review.
You know what, I must just caution you on this. It's great to hear these statements, but the reality is, you would have had, I hope, the opportunity to say this under the bill at that time that put forward the Act. This is now an Act. We're dealing with the amendment of this Act to this Act. And, you know, the point is we're not dealing with the Act itself. So what I want you to do is to just refocus your input here in such a way that you deal with the amendment bill that we are trying to deal with. That's what we're trying to deal with in relation to the companies.
That's right.
So clearly the amendment bill that DTI drew up and tabled here in Parliament was intended to address certain areas that technical areas, I mean it's actually called a rectification processes as far as I'm aware. So if you can just realign the input you are making here. Regrettably I don't have, and I don't think members of the committee have this PowerPoint, so I don't know what's coming after. Do you follow? And that's what makes it a bit difficult as well. So I've got no knowledge of where this is heading to. I have to plow through the expanded version. So, yes, if you can continue from that point and then agree to make the PowerPoint available in some form of manner electronically to the committee secretary so we can get, or if you've got a hard copy, get a photostat.
Thank you for that comment, and it's exactly my thoughts as well. We're just creating context. Many people made submissions on the Amendment Act, and we just needed to provide context for the members and ourselves, I suppose, in when they consider these proposed amendments by stakeholders, that they know that there are certain limits in which they must be analysed. And therefore, we're highlighting the core issues of the Companies Act, and then obviously when we get to our specific comments, things will become clearer. So emulate international best practice. You'll see later on how the Amendment Bill and the Companies Act perform this requirement. As a general comment, the simplification in the Companies Act, I've highlighted, and it's in our submission as well. Section 11, for instance, allow a registration number as a name of a company. And so simplification is clear in the legislation. It's in our proposed submission. Then the core principle of the Companies Act is this concept, because it combines two legislations into one, it's called differential governance. The company, there's public companies, listed companies, non-owner-managed private companies, owner-managed private companies, all thrown into this unitary company act which we have in front of us. So you cannot say increase regulation for all companies. It doesn't make sense because there's owner-managed private companies that don't need that regulation. So one must be very, very careful. The late Deputy Minister of Agriculture, I think, coined the phrase, and very appropriately so, and I full-heartedly agree with this, the legal system should look beyond the class interests of the business elite, which might be the bigger entities, doing justice to all classes, applying the moral imperative. All right, so this is just a diagrammatical example, display of how the Companies Act combines the two statutes, and it ends up with this thing called differential reporting. 5% of companies are classified, or possibly would, in our estimation, be classified as public interest. They'd either be listed, they'd be public companies issuing shares, or they would be of a certain threshold or to perform a certain activity. They would require IFRS and an audit. We full-heartedly support the current amendments. Many commentators said that they wish it to change. We disagree with them. We say it shouldn't change. The amendments are appropriate and fine. It should be go through as is. And this is what the Companies Act amendments and the draft regulations in our estimate tries to achieve. 5% of companies should follow the highest form of reporting, IFRS, and should get audits, because audits is linked to public interest. 10% of companies can be classified as non-public interest, very important concept, non-public interest and non-owner managed. They follow a thing called IFRS for SME, and they get the independent review. This concept is highly important. The independent review is not for public interest companies. It's never intended to be that. And hence, the regulation is different than for an audit. The standard prescribed in the draft regulations is called ISRE 2400. It's an accepted international standard. Many European states already apply ISRE 2400, and indeed, the regulation and monitoring of ISRE 2400 is not given in all instances to the regulator of auditing in those jurisdictions. In many jurisdictions, professional body perform the monitoring function on the ISRE 2400, so we believe this international precedent for how the amendment bill and regulation suggest the independent review should be performed. There is still some strengthening that needs to be done relating to the qualification of the person that will perform the independent review. We made suggestions in our submissions on that. And then lastly, we get to 85% of companies, which is also in the Companies Act. They are non-public interest, again, very important, owner-managed entities. These are the old CCs that we were all familiar with. They should not be prescribed to follow a particular financial reporting standards, and indeed the Companies Act and the Bill do not prescribe such a standard for them. And they will be free to choose themselves whether in the memorandum of incorporation or be requested by a bank to get either an independent review or an audit. So very important triangle. And what effect does this have? If you can just switch the triangle around again, and then you can see on tax collection what the effect is. In my estimate, in conversations with various people, big companies give 85% of all tax revenues. These are the ones that you want to be audited and follow the highest form of reporting and governance. But obviously the triangle gets smaller as you go lower, and you end up with owner-managed entities, the smaller guys, only contributing marginally to the whole tax source of South Africa, so that the introduction of the independent review will not affect South Africa's collection of revenue, not in our estimate. So I mentioned previously how the Act then replaces auditing with other monitoring mechanisms, and here's a list of them. This is by no means complete. Reckless trading prohibited. There's administrative penalties for not keeping your books in a correct format. There's administrative penalties if your financial statements are not prepared appropriately. There's penalties for the preparer of those financial statements. Then there's a Chapter 3 which increases the requirement for certain types of companies. There's codifying of standards for directors, and then most importantly, the Companies Commission isn't the old CIPR that we are familiar with. It becomes an enforcer of company law. It actively takes complaints. It actively investigates them. They issue compliance notices. They issue summons. They have search and seizure powers, and there's a Companies Tribunal. So in our estimate, when you consider the submissions previously made on the independent review and the audit, please consider the holistic approach in governance embedded within the company law, and hence our submission that the amendments is appropriate as they are. Judge Dennis Davis in his book also mentioned the enlightened shareholder value approach to company law, which is a fundamental different way of protecting minorities and other shareholders. So now we come to the specific comments. Accounting records, we suggest an amendment to how it's currently defined. The Act also, or the amendment, proposes a definition for assets, creditors, and liabilities. We suggest that it should not give a definition for those. It should follow the common law definition of what those are. It's a very serious point that we make there, that if you define an asset, outside of common law, you might there will be uncertainty on whether a company actually could reflect an item as an asset or not. So 1973 Act did not define assets. The UK company law do not define assets. Neither should our own Act. There's common law defining those things. The definition of auditing currently, we agree with it and support it. Independent review is just clarified, not me being an audit. And on this point, we believe, I have a slide on that point, so I'll come back to that one later on. Section 29.1, again, we agree with the current requirements. Small owner-managed companies should not follow a prescribed financial reporting standard. It's unnecessary. It's an additional burden. There's other alternatives available for them. Section 30 and 84, we agree with the clarity that's provided. Again, with Section 72, we've given our reasons there. And we found just something, perhaps a drafting issue on Section 109. The persons that will be the members of the Financial Reporting Standards Council. There's a new insertion there which wasn't previously in the first draft of the amendments, which says that the minister must appoint one person nominated by the body governing the regulation of the accounting profession. Now, there is no such body governing the accounting profession. I suggest that it should be reading the one person nominated by the Accounting Practices Board, which I think is the entity they wanted to refer there to. We need to clarify on Section 134, Business Rescue, again, just a minor drafting issue. The person that is allowed to act as a business rescue provider, what type of regulatory authority should he be subject to before he's appointed? And then there's specific replies that I want to, which will add to our submission. SAR suggested that there should be verification of financial statements for all companies. Our response would be that there's extensive requirements on the form and content of accounting records and how they should be kept. This makes this independent verification of financial statements unnecessary. We will overburden the SME market if that's a requirement. Reportable irregularities were suggested to be performed by the independent review provider. We would caution against this, although not totally opposed to it. The independent review do not provide a check on internal controls. It's inherent in the standard, so it's an alternative to the audit and less costly. And how it's less costly is because there's a removal of certain activities. It's not a check on internal control, and then would provide very limited information on reportable irregularities in any event. And then the Act provides, and this is the most important point, abundant alternative monitoring in the new Companies Commission. On the IRBA submission, we believe the IRBA regulates auditors who act in the public interest. The independent review has never been designed to protect public interest because it's not applicable to the public interest companies. The Companies Act defines what a public interest company would be, or the regulations will do this, and once you define this public interest, you get an audit. It's an automatic requirement, it's an obligation that you should get an audit. The independent review standard, there's an international standard proposed. It's done in Europe, in many, many other countries. We also included in our submission a summary of the European Federation of Accountants survey of how alternative assurance works in Europe. So that is an excellent piece of material. It explains to you how independent review using the standard ISRE 2400 is implemented in other countries, which gives ample examples of that it's not necessary to be regulated by a state regulator. There's many other examples, basically because it's not a public interest requirement. And monitoring has many forms. It's an important point also to remember when we speak about the independent review. The international community do not prescribe how you should monitor or regulate. That's for each jurisdiction to decide. All that the international community would say is it's important that you monitor and regulate. But we can decide the how of the affair. The IRBA regulates auditors. There was just this last point I needed to make. The qualification for the independent review provider is important. That's perhaps an omission which is in the regulations. We believe that the International Federation of Accountants, IFAC, sets education standards. And indeed, it was a requirement in the first draft amendment bill and in the regulations that one should be a member of an IFAC professional body. the ISRE 2400 standard has a certain context, and that context is provided by the International Federation of Accountants. So you first start with education. You have to have a certain qualification and practical experience before you do an independent review. And then IFAC also prescribes quality monitoring mechanisms so that all members of IFAC have these things in place. And only then do you get to the ISRE 2400 standard. So it will address all of the concerns raised by the IBA if the independent review is more closely linked to the International Federation of Accountants. And that's our submission.
Right. Thank you very much, Mr. Van Veek. As I say, I certainly am going to appreciate the PowerPoint for the members of the committee electronically, and also if you've got a hard copy, please. Members of the committee, you did have the expanded version in the larger pack. I hope all of you have been able to follow it there. And there's a matrix at the back, which has been very helpful to myself in the interim. Are there any questions on the left from members and comments? Honourable Harris, let me allow that Honourable Harris just to go ahead at the moment.
Just on the extensive suggestions and proposals, rather, around the definitions, I'm just interested if the presenters made inputs into the original Act in line with those proposals, or are these new with respect to the bill?
Yes, the thanks. There was no previous suggestions on definitions related to assets, creditors, and liabilities, not in the Act, nor in the first draft of the proposed amendments. It was only now in this version that the definitions was included, so this is the first time that we raised the issue.
Once again, looking at the committee, they may have had a chance to... I think it's very difficult. I know I'm looking at it here, and some sort of hard copy. You can see the importance it is for members to be able to just engage on this. Honourable Albert and Honourable Smalley.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure if I did see that in your presentation, but the standards or qualifications needed for somebody to be appointed as an independent reviewer. Do you have any views on that? That would be in accordance with international obligations, but it also will work for South Africa's context. Thank you.
Okay, I think just touching on that on section 134, also their view of the standards or what a that meaning of the regulatory. You know, what do you guys see as that that specific standards how that person should be appointed? You know, if I can just understand that, because I do look at your concern there, but I want to find a solution, maybe your solution to the problem or to your own concern.
Right, I'm very pleased you've just kept this up. Just go through this again for some of us, and also just unpack the abbreviations. Thank you.
If you will, I will start with the last question. I think that's the most important one. The triangle here reflects the Companies Act framework. So that's what I try to illuminate. It's a combination of public interest and public companies at the top. Then it provides for other types of companies. I refer to them as non, they don't have public interest, they're not classified as such, but they're not all of the shareholders of the company are also directors of the company. So there's an agency issue. And then lastly, you get the non-public interest entities, and all of the shareholders are directors in the entity. So once all shareholders are directors, you remove the concept of agency. It means that the shareholder and the director is one person, so he's responsible for his own business. And indeed, SARS has a PAYE legislation that makes the directors of a company personally liable if they don't pay their PAYE, for instance, on behalf of the company. And this will be the case then also for those owner-managed entities. So using, once you've identified the different types of entities provided for within the Company Act, you can start deciding the level of regulation you want attached to each one, obviously determined by their public interest. So the top 5% of companies, that's, if you estimate we have 1.1 million companies and CCs actively trading, 5% of that is 57,500. Those are the guys that pay, in our estimate, 80-85% of all tax revenue. They are the ones that you want to control. They've got the biggest impact on the economy and the environment and the people that work for them. Therefore, you require, when they prepare financial statements, they should prepare them in accordance with a higher standard. And that standard is called International Financial Reporting Standards. Those financial statements should then also be subject to an audit by a registered auditor to provide the necessary public interest as stated by the IRBA. But when you go now below the line, you get a different type of animal, a different type of company. There's no public interest, and the regulations defines exactly what, how. So it's important that those definitions is correctly defined. However, there's still agency, because not all the shareholders are also managers. So you need to protect, to a limited extent, those shareholders. And hence you would require a lower form of financial reporting, and you would require a lower form of review or reporting on financial statements. Now, on this point, it's important to remember that South Africa for 20 years had accounting offices for closed corporations. What the independent review does in our estimate is to increase, to enhance the accounting officer model by proposing a standard for accounting offices, which wasn't previously there. And in our previous submissions to the DTI, and the previous versions of the regulations had it in, we linked the independent review to the IFAC standard. And then we said that a person, and this is in response to the first question, the independent review qualification, it should only be performed by a person that adheres to the IFAC standards of education, or whose professional body requires him to have the IFAC standard of education and experience, to have the to adhere to the IFAC quality control standard. Now that IFAC quality control standard, it's once a professional body adheres to it or subscribes to it via its constitution, it's then obligated to enforce that standard. So the legislation is kept simple by not prescribing the quality control mechanism. It's embedded in, it's assumed within the understanding of the standard that once a professional body adheres to the IFAC standards, the professional body is obligated by that adherence to follow the IFAC quality control standards and monitor its own members, review the practice of independent review, and place these people under investigation disciplinary if they don't perform. It's also an obligation on the person performing the independent review to ensure that he's capable of performing it and has the necessary qualification and experience. So the regulation is there not via the Act or a state regulator, it's via a professional body, and the question then is, but why is this appropriate? Again, because of the important concept of non-public interest. As soon as a thing is not public interest, perhaps the question is there not an alternative way of achieving the same thing, which is less costly to business, but still strengthens reporting? And in our estimate, this is what the independent review does. And then lastly, you get to the owner-managed companies, the non-public interest ones, the largest portion of all, creators of employment. They need to be nurtured. They should not be overburdened, and we think the Act achieved this by not prescribing a financial reporting standard. The CC Act also did not prescribe one. It said you must follow a standard as appropriate for the business, so there was a lot of flexibility again. And then what the experience was in the UK, just to, for your estimate, okay, now 85% of companies don't have to follow an audit anymore, but practically speaking, they found in the United Kingdom, when they implemented audit exemption in 1989, that only 50% of companies opted for audit exemption. So it's not going away, it's becoming voluntarily. So what happens is that the credit provider will not give a loan unless you give him an audited financial statement. But the point is that, and the benefit is that audit isn't just prescribed for everybody because it's a good idea. It has more purpose and more value because it's being required by the market where it's needed. The other 50 other parts, other companies decide voluntarily themselves they still want this, it will improve their standing, and then they would prescribe it within their memorandum of incorporation. That's the term MOI, which is quite a powerful document in the New Companies Act, the memorandum of incorporation. So I've addressed the question of the triangle, I've explained it. I've addressed the question of the qualification for the independent review provider, and then there was a last question on section 134. It just says that if you're a member of the accounting fraternity or the legal fraternity or as part of auditing and you're regulated, then you are allowed to perform or become a business rescue provider. The point is that the accounting profession isn't regulated in South Africa. So there's perhaps a misunderstanding that does it refer to an accounting officer being co-regulated within the CC Act, because there's certain requirements for account before a person can act as an accounting officer, but he doesn't have an active regulator. So, or does it mean a state-funded regulator like the IRBA or the entity regulating the legal fraternity?
Which clause was that in the amendment bill?
That is section 134. There it is. It says a person may be appointed as the business rescue practitioner of a company only if the person is a member in good standing of a legal, accounting, or business management profession that is subject to regulation. Now, business management profession isn't subject, there is no such regulation, and there's no regulation for accounting. I think, if I may suggest, the meaning to be a member of the legal and auditing fraternity subject to regulation or profession. It just needs to be clarified what the meaning was.
Right. Thank you. Are there any other questions or comments? Honourable September, Honourable Alberts.
Chair, thank you. In the broader pack that they gave us, it's quite helpful, Chair, if you go through and see the proposals that are being made in this regard. What I do want to know, though, is just to clarify a little bit more from you. On the aspect of assets, apart from what you have in the document, can you spell out a little bit more? One, the unintended consequence of if we leave the clause as is, and of course if we were to proceed, what is it? Is it a particular word or a particular sentence that you feel will lead towards what you term expropriation? And then on the last one, you, whilst you raise an issue on section 134, you don't make a proposal. Do you have a proposal in that regard, other than saying that you need, it needs to be clarified? Maybe a proposal to the committee would assist us. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Albert.
Thank you, Chair. Just with regard to section 134, business rescue practitioner, legal fraternity or the legal regulatory authority, that's also problematic, and the DTI must take note of this. It's only lawyers who are regulated by Act of Parliament which have a body statutory created. Advocates don't have a body like that. They are regulated by common law. So there's no regulatory authority for advocates as such, even if you belong to the bar. The bar is a self-regulated institution. So you've got to take note of that. I don't see a problem with advocates trying to do this type of work, but obviously you need to take account of industries which are self-regulated to a great degree, even though they are professionals. Thank you.
Right. I think the point that Honourable September made is very useful. I'm not sure if you have a proposal forward now to come up with, whether you want to send that to the committee in writing subsequently, which you're welcome to do. I also think the points which have been made about who's regulated and who isn't, that certainly this is something the committee will look at just to ensure possibly there aren't any typos that may have just crept in to this area and so on, to ensure that we are fully covered here. And because I was thinking, you know, accountants, did I hear you saying they were not covered by a regulatory authority? Is that what you were saying? And yet, from what I understood, I mean, these accountants would now be capable of a lot of this work, as it were, you know, under the proposed amendment bill. So, yes, it would be useful if you would come up with some sort of proposal to the committee in this regard, because I think you're saying you're not opposed to this per se, but rather you're just pointing it out that these don't have regulatory, what did you call them, bodies or whatever, authorities. All right. So let's just move on then from here, from there. The other thing was the section here that we were looking at, 138, under the, I think it's page 41 of the amendment, not 40, yeah, 41 of the amendment bill, clause 84. It refers to 138. I can't, if you would just give us your comments on that area, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me then just start with the question related to the definition of assets. I would suggest that the definitions of assets, creditors, and liabilities be removed in the entirety. If you read the definition, it's a very narrow definition. It says in law the definition would be what the dictionary tells it what it is, and then obviously the context of the case will be considered by a judge. So that will be, so that's the definition in law of an asset. But if you look at the definition as currently provided, that definition is sourced from the accounting definition of an asset. It says it's a resource controlled by the entity. Now what happens about an asset that's owned by the entity? And then it talks about from which future economic benefits will be derived. Now what happens if there's no future economic benefit? Because accounting is drafted in terms of economic laws, what makes sense on financial transactions, so that the financial statement is more understandable. But that's not necessarily the same meaning as the common law would attach to an asset. So the effect might be, and we're just trying to indicate that there might be a serious implication once the Act becomes effective and then imposes the asset definition on all companies, which actually then jettisons the common law and says this is now the definition of an asset. We think that's not appropriate. The example is of a lessee and a lessee where the bank owns the asset but then sells it to you via a lease agreement. In accounting, that asset is then shown in your financial statements as your asset. But legally speaking, it's not your asset, it's the bank's asset. And this definition then bypasses that relationship and then says, no, it's no longer the bank's asset. We need to get clarity on it. It will be just easy to remove the definitions. It wasn't in our older Companies Act, and it's not in a new UK company law either. I suggest it might have been included to clarify solvency and liquidity issues maybe. But then the definition should be moved to Section 29 perhaps, or Section 22, which deals with insolvency and reckless trading. The business rescue practitioners and their qualification, Section 138 does make two provisions for how a person can qualify as a business rescue practitioner. The first one is that you're a member of a profession that's regulated. Now the problem there, that's fine, because then you at least ensure that there's some kind of a reporting mechanism if he didn't perform his job as he should have had. There are, however, in the accounting profession, currently a process of voluntary regulation, where a person becomes a member of an institute, he then subscribes to the rules, and if that professional body is a member of IFAC, the International Federation of Accountants performs a kind of a monitoring function on that professional body. So we have an issue in South Africa that not all professional bodies are members of IFAC, which kind of creates different standards within the profession. I'm not asking for the regulation of the accounting profession, by no means. It's not done anywhere in the world, which I recall. It's always the auditing profession. And if the members recall, in 2005, when we introduced the Auditing Profession Act, that was one of the fundamental principles of the Auditing Profession Act. There was talk back then that accountants and auditors should be regulated under one act. But then Dr. Len Kona, he drafted the white paper, and it was clearly set out there that to ensure the independence of auditors, they should not be included with accountants as and be regulated, and that would provide, this was just after a few financial crises that we had at that time. So the suggestion would be that the 1381I, Roman 1, should be the persons regulated by an act of South Africa, and that would include in obviously auditors. And then section 2 would, there you would become a rescue practitioner if you apply to the company's commission and prove your incompetence. Although it still would be an open question why a person that's an attorney and an auditor would suddenly be capable of doing business rescue. That maybe they should prescribe more experience requirements to ensure that they can perform the work. But we will give a more formal written submission if that would be helpful.
That would be extremely helpful, I think, because there's a fairly critical points for us to be able to study. Understand that the committee, look, if we have any further questions, let's put them together once we've had the opportunity to digest this and then refer them on to the relevant people, as we keep on saying in this regard. But certainly we'd like to thank Mr. Nicholas van Beek and Ms. Cindy Parvis. Is that correct? Is that correct? Right. Of the Association of Chartered Certified Accountants. Is that correct? Yes. Thank you. Now, if we can then move to PwC, PricewaterhouseCoopers. It's Mr. Tabani Jali, Executive Chairman, and Mrs. Carla, you know, I can't really read this well, as a Goodricks, Associate Director, Legal Compliance, and Mr. Herman Bossman, I'm not too sure where Mr. Bossman is, Senior Manager, Technical. Right. PwC. Now, I know you've been with us for some time in the day, so you have a pretty good idea on what to focus. I know I won't have to repeat myself. Thank you. Members, some of you are looking at me. I don't know if you were thinking it could be tea break. It's nowhere near tea break. Right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I now go ahead? Yes, thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to do this presentation. The mic is not working.
No.
Oh, I must look into the mic.
Well, not so much.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to look into the mic and also appreciate the opportunity to make the comments on the amendment bill that aims to amend the errors and better provide for the administration of the Principal Act. As you rightly pointed out, we've been sitting here and we'll try to focus on those areas which are of relevance to the committee today. we did make a written submission, which I hope members are in possession of. In that written submission, we had a number of points which we raised, but our oral submission today will merely deal with the three matters of principle which we think we need to highlight. I think two of them have already been touched upon by the other presenters before this committee, so I will not spend much time on them. And then I won't spend much time on the detailed comment on specific sections and the minor amendments that affect some of the principle. And secondly, we are aware of the regulations which have just been put on the web, but we haven't had an opportunity to study them in detail. So some of the presentations we might be making maybe have already been covered, but we will touch on them if need be. The first point we'd like to make is covered in page 6 of the bill, that is the definition of the audit. The main philosophy of our presentation in this regard is that we like review to be equivalent, to be given an equivalent status to an audit. That's the main philosophy of what our presentation is all about. The bill proposes in the definition of an audit that independent reviews are not included in this definition, and therefore independent reviews will not be governed by the regulatory body, which, as we know, it is RBA, which did a presentation here earlier. And also it has just transpired in the latest submission that if they were to be looked into by as an accounting function, there is no regulatory body which actually regulates the accounting function per se. We believe that at the present moment, RBA is the only regulator that can achieve consistency amongst independent reviews conducted. By the proposed exclusion of independent reviews from the definition of audit, the independent regulatory body for audit is thus by implication scooped out of the ambit of regulation of the reviews. From the reference to the Audit Professions Act, an audit should be conducted by an auditor registered at an independent regulatory board for auditors. However, no reference is made to an independent reviewer and the regulatory body governing these reviews. We believe that the proposed inclusion of the underlined wording should be removed, and then this matter should be dealt with by way of an amendment in the Auditing Professions Act to ensure that consistency is achieved with the governance of independent reviews. With an independent review intended also to provide assurance to stakeholders, it is important to put it in an equivalent legal basis to that of an audit. That is the main thrust of this particular submission, Madam Chair. And then I'll move on to the next point I'd like to make, which is covered in page 9 of the bill. That is section 41A of the bill. Again, the main philosophy of our submission in this regard is the fact that it has always been an accepted legal principle that companies are separate legal entities, and thus are separate legal entities. They've got their own assets and liabilities, and whatever happens with regard to those individual companies is falls within that particular company. So in our submission, we submit that in applying the solvency and liquidity test, only the assets and liabilities of the company itself should be considered. Companies should not be permitted to consider the assets and liabilities of holding and subsidiary companies in determining whether solvency and liquidity tests are met, as such subsidiaries and holding companies are separate legal entities, and any resultant claims will not be enforceable against these other legal entities. In determining whether solvency and liquidity tests has been met for a holding company, the Act required the consideration of the consolidated assets and liabilities of the company. Current corporate and insolvency law deals with each legal entity separately and not a consolidated or on a group basis. that is what the current amendment is contrary to the accepted legal current legal position. It will seem as if the intention of the provision is to introduce an anti-abuse mechanism, but in its current format, it might lead to the direct opposite effect, in that it could be abused by some holding company or a subsidiary if its position is not in a solvent position. This essentially introduces a group of companies concept, where a holding company is allowed to rely on the assets of its subsidiaries and obliged to take account of liabilities of its subsidiaries. If, for example, a holding company is a wholly owned significant subsidiary for which the liabilities exceed the assets significantly, that holding company will not meet the solvency and liquidity test and cannot therefore enter into transactions in its statutory capacity. In addition, the holding company does not have direct access to the assets and liabilities of its subsidiaries. So it's a bit difficult to say how can that be taken into consideration in deciding its solvency position. Therefore, the inclusion of its assets and liabilities of the subsidiary will not help to achieve the solvency and liquidity test of the holding company in its statutory capacity. In applying the solvency and liquidity test, only the assets and liabilities of the company itself should be considered. That is our submission. Companies should not be permitted to consider the assets and liabilities of holding subsidiary companies in determining whether solvency and liquidity are met, as such subsidiaries and holding companies are separate legal entities and any resulting claims will not be enforceable against these other legal entities. Madam Chair, that is the end of our submission in this regard. I'll then move on to the next slide, which deals with Section 30, Subsection 2, Capital A, which is contained at page 19 of the bill. Again, coming to this particular submission, I'll just say the main philosophy of our submission is to ensure that the audit exemption is for the benefit of those it was intended to benefit. Because looking at this particular provision, if you look at it, it looks like it may be open to abuse one way or the other. That's page 19. Is it? Is 19 or 20? It spills over to 20. It starts at page 19 of the bill. Unless the numbers change when we're copying the bill. Yeah, it's at the bottom of page 19, Madam Chair. Amendment of Section 30 of Excerpt 1 of 208. And then it goes over to page 20. Have you found? Oh, sorry. I thought you were still looking for it. I didn't want to proceed. No, okay. A person as defined in the Act includes a juristic person. And a juristic person is further defined as includes a foreign company and a trust, irrespective of whether or not it was established within or outside the Republic of South Africa. This would imply that if a juristic person like a company holds any shares in a private company, such private company will not qualify for the audit and a review exemption in terms of Section 30, Subsection 2A. However, if a company or a trust that holds the shares in such private company causes all its shares to be held by directors of such private company as its nominees, it could utilize the audit and review exemption. That is the current, as is currently constituted, the amendment. If it was the intention of the legislature to restrict the audit and review exemption to private companies where natural persons all hold all the shares or have all the beneficial interests in the shares and are also the directors, it would be in the best interest, I think, of the general public if it was to be clarified in the amendment bill. Because as it currently reads, that's not clearly the situation. For example, close corporations where generally all members are natural persons that have executive powers should also be afforded an audit and a review exemption. With the concomitant amendments to the Close Corporation Act, which in the alia amends Section 10 of the Close Corporation Act, I'm not sure whether that has been covered in terms of the regulations which have just come out, because I know as at the time of preparing the submission, that had not yet been promulgated, that particular amendment. Scoping in the Close Corporation Act for the audit or independent review by regulations in terms of the combatant affairs could have an unintended consequences for almost the 3 million closed corporations which are currently registered in the country that currently have no audit or review requirements. Closed corporations are similar in nature to private companies envisaged in Section 30, Subsection 2, Capital A of exemption. In our written submission, Madam Chair, we have suggested an amendment which we think might be appropriate. And I'd like to refer this committee to page 5 of 8 of our written submission. That's where the suggested amendment is contained. Madam Chair, in our written submission, other matters are pointed out that relate to errors and some cosmetic changes which we think need to be attended to. It is not our intention to elaborate on these, but wish to bring these under the attention of the Portfolio Committee. And we'd like to thank you, Madam Chair, and the rest of the members of the committee for the opportunity to present before you. Thank you. We'll take questions.
Just a minute. So you're saying on page 5 you've got those proposals, have you?
Yes, in our recent submission.
Mm-hmm.
Page 5 of our recent submission. Mm-hmm. We have the suggested amendment.
Right, I've got them.
I don't have to read it either. It's there.
You don't have to read them. Thank you. They're quite clear. Right. Members, and thank you very, very much for that input there. Input from Mr. Jali. Thank you. Members of the committee, do we have any comments, questions, calls for clarification? I know with some about some of the overheads have just come through to us, and they are so much clearer than the earlier expanded text that we got. So members may well be scrutinising and perusing those. But yes, do we have any hands? Honourable Smiley, are you ready to? Right.
Chair, it's more on the first concern on the definition of audit and trying to bring your review to equal basis or definition of equal basis, if I do recall that right. Companies should be audited on an annual basis, and the section makes provisions for review. And there were some of the earlier presentations that didn't want to have companies to be reviewed during the course of a financial year due to financial burden. And I'm trying to understand why you want to bring review into the same standing as audit. Is it just a wording of definition, or will it also bring a financial implication then further into companies if they've then got to review if the financial statements or issues has got to be reviewed during a certain period of time. I don't know if you do, if you're with me, ma'am.
Yes, no, I'm certainly with you. You're on board there?
Yes, I'm on board.
Our
submission is more about making sure that it's properly defined so that it can be brought under regulation. Somebody could regulate it. It's more about ensuring that it's properly regulated, that particular aspect. And thus, that's one. And secondly, the definition to be in accordance with the definition as contained in the other act, instead of trying to amend the other act through the Companies Act. Those are the two points we're trying to make. Because if you currently read the Companies Act, it seeks to be amending the Auditing Professions Act, or the definition as contained there. I think, if I'm not mistaken, the RBA also made almost a similar point earlier on, where they said, I can't remember if it was the IRBA or somebody before the IRBA who said, rather say this will be the definition for purposes of the Companies Act. Because otherwise, as it's currently drafted, it's seeking to amend the other act. Because that's how the general public understands it, and otherwise it creates confusion.
Honorable Kwabasa.
Thank you, Chairperson. On page 4 of 8, the second last block, where you indicate error stroke in consistency, the next block following that error or inconsistency. In your explanatory note, what you say there is quite acceptable. It makes a lot of sense. But in your last block, next to it, where you say the company should satisfy the solvency and liquidity test only where assets fairly valued exceed liabilities, comma, fairly valued and not where these are equal. Could you explain that? Because my little understanding suggests that you are saying a company should not be should not be seen as solvent if the assets and liabilities fairly valued are equal. Now, in a state like that, if that is what you're suggesting, what then would be the legal status of a company?
Where the assets and liabilities are equal?
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
Yes,
thanks.
Mr. Jali, is this a further clarification you require?
No, I couldn't understand when you talk about what will be the situation.
Yeah, we can't
what
hear
like
you
that.
With me on. I just thought I'd let you know.
And vice versa when somebody else is on. Well, he can now speak.
Oh, sorry, I didn't realize that. I thought we could all talk at the same time. I just wanted to see clarification. When you say what will be the situation, you mean where the assets are equivalent to the liabilities?
Yes, you, in your submission, you seem not to be agreeing with the earlier paragraph, which I would imagine is in the bill, the middle paragraph. In the next one, you don't seem to be agreeing with it. You're suggesting, where you say proposed amendment, that's your proposed amendment. And I'm saying to you, if that is what you are proposing, in a state where the situation was that the assets equal liabilities, If that is what you're proposing, what then would be the legal status? Could you explain that? What would be the legal status of trust of the company? Would it have to wind up and close shop?
Thank you.
Was that
the
Yeah. If you, over to yourself, Mr.
Well,
Jack.
A short answer to the question will be that where assets are equal liabilities, it's neither legally insolvent or commercially insolvent. So it can trade. It doesn't have to be wound up.
Come in there. I'm not sure if it was PwC or some other company or entity making a submission, but someone said here in the course of the public hearings that when referring to assets under definitions and so on, you can even have a situation where an asset doesn't have a financial value. Of course, I did, personally question that, but I didn't raise that. Now, if this is indeed the case, assets, in your own understanding, then the asset would have a financial value of sorts, hence the applicability of fair value in that regard and so on. Am I correct? And at one point you raise, I think it is yourself, Mr. Jarley, here, about the concept of fair value. Again, I could be wrong, we've heard a number of submissions. Is that PwC who was raising that query about fair value? Wasn't yourselves then who were querying the concept of fair value?
I think it could be. I'd like to get my notes, Madam Chair. I think it could be us which may have raised the concept of fair value as to whether it is easily determinable in the current situation.
If I may, Madam Chi, we do refer to it on page 7 of our written submission. We refer to section 112, in that we say the term fair market value should be defined and reference should be made to the accountancy framework or other framework in which this should be determined. That's the submission we made regarding fees.
Thank you.
Kabasa, are you satisfied that the response you've had addresses your question?
Then, to an extent, it does. It does answer my question. I was just checking, wanting to know whether that submission, the last submission, the last block, is not contradictory to the earlier one. And if that is the case, and that's why I was raising the question, what is your position? What are you saying should be the position of a company in a case where liabilities and assets break even?
Are you in a position to respond immediately?
I'm trying to understand the exact question so that I could be able to respond immediately, because I thought I'd already covered the point to say both commercially and legally a company with equal assets and liabilities is not insolvent. But maybe one can respond more outside this and send a response, because I'm really struggling with understanding as to where it might be different to the current submission.
All right. I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll put it to you in writing. I'm sure that will assist us both. But at one point you were, I think it was PwC, talking about this issue of consolidated assets, etc., and that... I think the submission you were making is that a company should not have to consider the assets and liabilities holding company or subsidiary, that it should be a specific company's assets and liabilities you look at, and not that consolidated. In reference to 41A, page 9 of the amendment, from what I understand. And if you look at that one, page 9 of the... because here, the assets of the company, or if the company is a member of a group of companies in the case of whole, the consolidated assets as fairly valued. Now, it would seem that from time to time, it's possible, you know, I've learned one thing, that companies are very good at gym. A lot of financial gymnastics around the place, in all countries for that matter, not just simply South Africa. It's amazing how money jumps around from one subsidiary to another, and assets and the like, by a stroke of the pen virtually. Now, is your concern and the point that you're raising here, the issue and then the proposed amendment, etc., what actually informs it? What is it motivated by, perhaps is a better way of putting it? Can you help us so that we can get a better understanding where is this coming from and how is it going to help us develop a more robust piece of amendment legislation? So we're just trying to get a better understanding there.
Madam Chair, I'll talk about the legal aspect and then I'll let my colleague talk about the accounting aspect as to exactly, the auditing aspect, I'm sorry, exactly how, what implications that has got. Legally, each of those companies is a separate legal entity and the assets sit in one of that, in that one other holding company or a subsidiary and not in the other one. So, if you are sitting in the holding company, you don't have any access to the subsidiary companies. You do have, but that cannot assist you in terms of saying whether your liquidity test is fine or not, because that's a separate legal entity altogether. So that's the legal structure as currently we understand it, and that's how we've always viewed companies in a holding and subsidiary structure. When it comes to auditing, maybe my colleague will explain more.
Of course. Madam Chair, just to concur with that, you know, when liquidation strikes, then companies are, you know, on their own as entities and look to their own assets and liabilities to satisfy their claims. So it's always been the case, and as we understood it, to operate when you have to, from an auditing perspective, evaluate the solvency of a company, especially with a holding company where you could have a double counting whereby the holding company already has the investment in the subsidiary, which you can fairly value, and then adds onto that the consolidated value of the subsidiary as well. Thank you.
Well, we have a better understanding of where the submission is coming from, and I don't think there are any more. Is there one, Honourable September? Yes.
Chair, just a very quick one on the, I think the section that you just spoke about now. I just want to find out in what you are proposing to us, to what extent are workers covered in it or are being taken into consideration, if at all?
Thank you very much. Over to yourself, Mr. Jali.
Is the question relating to the issue of the solvency test as to whether the workers will be covered insofar as that is concerned?
Honourable September.
I didn't hear his question, but it's about solvency and liquidity.
Solvency. Insolvency, solvency situation.
Well, our submission was confined to the actual test as to whether it's solvent or not. I think the workers will be covered in the process, in the insolvency process, as to whatever protections which are coming in terms of the Insolvency Act. We're just talking about the solvency test, liquidity and solvency test for a particular company.
Honourable September? All right. Well, as I said earlier, I think as we have the opportunity to study, you must appreciate there's a huge volume of documentation facing the committee. We need to be able to digest this, and then we certainly will be coming back to a number of you who've made submissions for further clarification in this regard, and I'm sure you'll understand that. And if we can agree on that basis. But thank you very much for coming here, and I think the format of a page and a section and an issue and all of this makes it that much easier for us to follow. And it is something that indeed one would hope to encourage other submissions to pursue. Thank you very much. It certainly assists us in following through. Thank you. Now, if we can move on to the, is it the Southern Institute for Business Accountants? The Southern African Institute for Business Accountants, SAIBA. It looks like Mr. Steon Kloo. Are you there, Mr. Steon Kloo? Right. Thank you very much. And we really, the previous one, I'm just saying anyone sitting here who's got their hard copies of the PowerPoints, the ones we haven't had, please give them to our committee secretary or make the electronic version available. Some members are leaving and will only be returning to Parliament on about the 15th of January. So really we need this. It's an encouragement perhaps just to ensure we get it. Right, Mr. Kloo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can see the honourable members are tired, and there are some advantages and disadvantages of being the last speaker. So I'll try to keep it sweet and short. I think the majority of the concerns has been addressed, but coming from a professional body, I think I need to declare our interest in this, in presenting this submission. Various views have been presented over the last 2 days. I had the privilege of being in attendance for both these days. I think from a starting point, if I can make the recommendation to the committee, that one has to consider the views holistically. And being from a professional body who holds our members the right to act as accounting officers, which I'll come to in a moment, obviously we would support the independent review and the regulations released on Monday. So I just had to declare that from the outset. I think one has to just make sure that we strike an appropriate balance between the requirements and the needs of our country to grow and to create jobs and to alleviate poverty and regulation. Madam Chair, if I may I'm not going to take too much time in presenting our comments. However, may I proceed to just provide a brief background as to the Institute of Business Accountants. Now, the Institute, may I proceed, Madam Chair?
You learn fast. if we can just indicate to members, I know this will sweeten the whole thing. Ernst & Young won't actually be coming. They have sent in a written submission, as you know. So you can cheer up a little on this graveyard shift. And yes, Mr. Kloo, everyone has got some sort of personal interest. to be here, other than DTI, who here with the department itself. So I don't think you're isolated in that regard at all. If anything, the only people who aren't here for some personal gain, if you like, is Parliament. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sketching a background on the Institute and why we are here today. The Institute is one of 8 professional bodies so-called accredited or announced by the Minister of Trade and Industry in the Government Gazette to perform the accounting officer function. And other legislation who has adopted this accounting officer regime is the Sectional Titles Act, the South African Schools Act, Non-Profit Organizations Act, and the National Credit Act. Now, those various legislation acknowledge the role that accounting officers play in the accounting profession. And those 8 professional bodies who are accredited, so-called, by the minister, adheres to and upholds high professional standards for its members. And that would have been a requirement, and a minimum academic qualification would have been one of the requirements for the minister to approve those professional bodies to perform the function of an accounting officer. For example, the professional bodies has code of conducts for the members that they need to adhere to. They've got a disciplinary committee, committees, and also members' handbooks. So those are the high professional standards that the members should adhere to make sure that they perform their function adequately. As a way of introduction, going into the specific commentary, that being said at the background where we come from, so that the members can understand who we are and who we represent. First of all, I would like to thank the committee and the department for being here and to providing us the opportunity to comment on the company's amendment bill. And secondly, we would like to congratulate the DTI for their hard work to reform the company law in South Africa. It has been a major project, as has been indicated. It's been coming over 6 years, and we are of the view that we now need to push forward. Yes, everything has growing pains, but we believe that we should address it as we go along. It's time for us to move on and make sure that we implement this this major piece of legislation, which in our view is quite a good piece of legislation. And also we are confident that CIPRA would be able to, that it can implement the Act by 1 April. That was one of the questions earlier. In terms of the specific comment, moving on to a specific comment, we support the amendments proposed in Section 1 of the Companies Act by excluding the word independent review from the definition of an audit. We do take cognizance of the fact that there may be a conflict between the Auditing Profession Act, that this Act would now say that it excludes it, but in that case we would recommend, in like SAICA, that should then be addressed. But we do agree that an independent review is not an audit function, but something similar, which is in line with international precedent. We also
text. Exactly where are you? This is because you haven't actually submitted to us the PowerPoint. I thought perhaps, seeing as you were here on the first day, you got the message. But you didn't. Well, as you see now, we're trying to follow and see where you are. Ahead. Page 2, we were told of your expansion.
Okay, we found it. Thank you. Apologies for that. Then, obviously, with hand in hand, going with that amendment in Section 1 to exclude, or to include independent review, apologies, to include it, We also say that, well, you recommended, or the amendment is now saying that an independent review of a company's annual financial statements required by this section does not constitute an audit within the meaning of that act. So why do we support the amendment and the exclusion of an independent review as from an audit, or distinguishing the two from each other? And that's in line with my learned previous colleague who presented from ACCA, who recommended also that with this non-public interest, that there should not be an audit performed on the annual financial statements of that company. Now, the reasons why we support it emulates international best practices. Across the world, there's different initial reporting. And also, most importantly, it's simplifying and reducing the cost of formation and maintenance of a legal entity, which in turn would stimulate employment growth, as well as alleviate poverty. Because in Africa, the SME, the small and medium enterprises in South Africa are the job creators in the future, and this has been even recognized recently by the G20 and also other countries. So it's something that we seriously have to look into to reduce the cost and to stimulate entrepreneurship, employment, and growth of the SME sector. We do, however, acknowledge the challenges with the current accounting officer regime. First of all, there are no standards, and there are varying academic and practical requirements of those 8 professional bodies which I referred to in my background, who are accredited to perform the accounting officer function. However, we believe that an enhancement of the accounting officer regime would address the issue and then the objectives of the Companies Act and the regulations, and the simplification of the regulation would be beneficial. Now, the benefits of the independent review regime now being introduced is that it will set the standard for accounting officers to perform the independent review if a public interest score is below 300, as being introduced in the latest draft regulations. And then also, one should adopt, as my ACCA colleague referred to earlier, one should then make it a requirement that these independent reviewers should adhere to IFAC international education standards to address the lack of qualification requirements currently in the accounting officer regime. So, to conclude, distinguishing the independent review from an audit is a major step in the right direction. It follows international precedent. It will certainly stimulate entrepreneurship, formalization of businesses in South Africa, and ultimately job creation. It will make it easier for small business to start up, to grow. Myself and my family's got small businesses, and the amount of red tape in managing a small business and the cost in managing a small business is becoming exorbitant. And we have to make sure that, and these companies, which I refer to, employ a number of individuals who were previously unemployed. So we have to make sure that the cost for operating a small business should come down, and the small businesses should also be in a position to be keen to formalize their affairs, because a lot of these small businesses who are informal keep on being informal. Studies have shown internationally, globally, that small businesses, due to the red tape and the cost of incorporating and adhering to the audit requirements, they rather stay under the radar and not face the costs of that involved. So the accounting officers are perfectly positioned in South Africa to fulfill the role of the independent review, and then the standard can be aligned by requiring, for example, an additional occupational certificate course in an independent review. So if the concern is that the current accounting officers, there are varying qualifications and varying experiential requirements, that can be addressed by the sector education and training authorities introducing an occupational certificate course to bring all of them onto the same standard, which can be done at a very low cost, and which can be subsidized and funded by the CETAs. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much then, Mr. Clue. And we'll now just ask members of the committee if they want to comment or any questions in this regard of the submission. Honourable Alberts is at the ready there. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Just with regard to standards, the independent reviewer, do you have any view on whether they should be regulated by the statutory body for auditors, what is it called, IRBA, or whether they should be placed within CIPRO themselves? Do you have any view on that? Thank you.
Yes, perhaps just as people warm up to the questions, you can respond to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Member. It's a contentious question which has been debated at a working group scheduled by the Department of Trade and Industry a while ago. And again, the accounting office is currently operating parallel to IRBA. So it's the accounting office are not falling under IRBA. Yes, there are challenges with the current model. Those are non-public interest organizations, the CCs and even with this public interest like Schools Act and the National Credit Regulator, as I pointed out earlier, the accounting officers do fulfill a very valuable role. So should they be subjected to further regulation? I would say no, because that will increase the cost of them operating. So again, the professional bodies are perfectly positioned to co-regulate with the DTI. I can also declare that a further interest, apart from my small businesses under which I operate, I'm the chief executive of the Institute of Tax Practitioners, and we're undergoing a similar question and study into the regulation of tax practitioners in South Africa. And our Australian colleagues recently introduced the regulation of tax practitioners in Australia, and what they essentially did, they established a commission or a board, but it is individuals sit on the board being nominated by practitioners and the public. They fulfill the role of a committee rather than a board with a fully fledged building and a CEO with a fat salary and computers, and which we can that money we can use better in South Africa. So what I've done in Australia, they have the board, but they only deal with disciplinary action. So they accredit the existing professional bodies, like the Chartered Accountants Institute, the Professional Accountants Institute, the ACCA, our equivalent Australian Tax Institute, and then those bodies would perform the education and the standard setting for the members. Obviously, those institutes would put forward the qualifications, the minimum qualifications to practice, and there will be a standard set. But the day-to-day operation of the tax practitioners, tax agents in Australia, would go on as normal. So they introduce regulation later on to ensure that the profession is regulated, or everything that's allowed. There's a saying going up, everything that's allowed. I forgot to say. But they overregulate in Australia. But still, they enhance the model by saying they acknowledge the role that professional bodies play and co-regulate it with government. So ultimately, disciplinary function would sit with the Independent Regulatory Board for tax practitioners. However, there's no body, physical building, there are no physical computers. It's a committee who sit and regulate the profession. The existing professional bodies with their infrastructure, with their continued professional development programs and code of conduct would make sure that members adhere to the minimum standards. So in that light, I would say then that if we do look across border, no, the current accounting officer model can be enhanced. It can follow the similar accreditation route than the Sectional Titles Act, the Schools Act, the Nonprofit Organizations Act, which we can now add the New Companies Act to that list.
Thank you, Mr. Clue. Honorable Alberts, were you responded to there? Yes. Honorable September?
Chair, thank you very much, and thank you very much for some of the enlightened views that you have shared. I know the bill has got quite a lot of amendments, and so I don't expect you to comment on all of them. But we've heard for the yesterday and today quite a lot of contrary views on a range of different things. And in order to assist us, is there any way that you would mind, you know, giving your own view? Because you, from what you have said thus far, you've got quite a number of strong views of your own in how things actually can work in another direction, motivated by, small business needs to benefit from all of it. If you don't mind, and Chair, may I take the liberty in asking that some of the issues that he's raising, I mean, arising really out of the question, is there any way, Chair, through you, to ask him whether he could pass on some of that information to this committee, because whether it's for this bill or any of our other work, I would imagine that it will benefit us quite a bit. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, thank you. I think that point would be shared by many of us. I noticed that Mr. Clue, you referred to Australia, okay, as one example, and clearly you may have a few other examples where this could be operating and so on in this light. And as I say, we've got a very thin little expanded text submission from you. It may not do justice to what you're saying, and of course we'd also welcome the PowerPoint as well. But see how far you can respond to Honourable September's question, although some of it was also a request through the chair, which indeed we will pursue through the committee secretary in that particular regard. Thank you. But if you can see where you can go with this now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Honourable Member, I'm not in a privileged position to spend too much time on the Companies Laws Amendment Bill. As I have to manage in my full-time position, I have to manage staff. But I think what is clear for me, being an outsider technically to the Companies Act, is that there are differentiating views. And I'm glad that I'm not a member of this committee, because you are bombarded with the different views, and how it's substantiated, it's up to you whether you will accept it or not. I just think that one needs to caution I'm actually probably shooting myself in the foot with my submission, but you have to see where the submission is coming from and then judge it accordingly, because not all stakeholders also are presenting here today, and being heavily involved in the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill annually, we see that clearly coming through in that process and that committee as well. They are vested interest, and being a core academic myself as well, it is sometimes difficult to really make out what would be really the benefit for the man on the street. And I think that should ultimately be the committee's the final question, whether they accept a proposal or recommendation, is how will the man on the street and how will our country and our economy and the poverty be alleviated once we pass this policy? Because behind all the words, obviously there's policy, and I would really like to see that ultimately that we look at the policy and what we try to achieve in the spirit of the law, and not necessarily in the words, because one can sometimes get confused when you mix the two. and you get confused all the words. So ultimately the question is, look at the purpose behind the legislation and the policy.
If I may, Chair, he answered like a politician.
No, I was just looking at that, if he was standing as an independent somewhere. But as I said earlier, Mr. Clue, everyone's come here with a particular viewpoint, yes, including yourself, of course. We just want as much information as we can, because this is a very important piece of legislation for everyone. The country as a whole, big business, medium, small, and yes, we're also looking at, you know, overall, how we transform our economic structure and so on. That is also very, very important to us as a development, striving towards some form of developmental state. So all these issues are important, but we still continue with our public hearings next year, possibly for a day or so. I think it is on the 19th, if I'm not mistaken. But before we do that, the committee wants the opportunity to go through this. It's a vast amount of work and a volume of information we've got here. And our concern as a committee is to ensure that policy priorities are met, but backed by robust legislation. It's as simple as that. Robust legislation that will stand the test of time and so on. And doesn't, if you like, simply earmark a particular group or that group, but it really does try to address the South African people, the economy, but also the key issue in our country, yes, is unemployment, yes, is small and medium companies. But at the same time, we need to ensure that the larger companies themselves hopefully transform enough to retain staff and we're all able to contribute, if you like, to the economy of a country in a responsible manner, you know. So I'm glad to hear you spent 2 days here, seeing as you say you almost, as it were, a one-man show there, in inverted commas, with staff, and I don't mean that facetiously, and you didn't even go to the beach yet. So I'm just looking at your age. So many young people do just head for the beach or something. So all that's very welcome, and your studious approach to things. Thank you very much. We will be coming back to you, as we will with a number of our submissions, if not all of them, notwithstanding how busy you've told us you are. All right. So because we do, you've made a submission, which means you're already open to us. Please. Now, those who made submissions are released. Thank you. And thank you very much. Drive home safely and do have a good opportunity to spend time with your families. With respect to the committee, this is our last committee meeting. We do have another meeting with IMF. We're not chairing that. You know, we are attending that committee meeting. It is essentially been run by the finance committee. I'm sure you all appreciate that. But this offers us the opportunity to just indicate that some members have said to me they don't have the strat plan of the committee. The committee. I'm not talking of DTI. And it is important that you have that strat plan, because you need to be able to look at that and say, this is what we have done in the same way we approach DTI. This is what we haven't done. Why haven't we done it? And how should we approach this next year when we review the strategic plan itself? So I think that's very important. So if you don't have a copy, speak to the committee secretary. So that's the strategic plan of the committee. I think those who've been here before are well aware of that. The second respect issue is study visits that should be looked at there. as well as oversight visits. Look at that issue. The third issue, and I know, Honourable Harris, you've often raised this with me personally and, of course, within the committee. There are some priorities we didn't address. And I can certainly give a good reason why not, but we need to review that and say, where do we place these? We also, and I'm sorry the Honourable September has left, I see her work still here, so I'm not too sure. But on the, what do you call it, the intellectual properties amendment bill, this was raised almost, in correcting the minutes, but it did remind me yet again. Where are we with this? We're here at the end of the year. We all knew we would be in this situation about 3 or 4 weeks ago. Do you recall that? That doesn't mean to say we're happy with the situation, just because we knew that. Now, there is no way we can simply take this off the radar screen of this committee. So I had rather hoped that we would be in a position here with the Honourable September having led the task team, but I mean, she has shared this with me as well. Where do we take this? I think the minutes to some extent reflect that, to some extent. Now, the big thing is to have the necessary people on board that we said we would have on board. To a large degree, we have already met them. I think you're all aware of that. It means contacting them and taking a position. It also means asking the task team, if you like, to almost matrix these positions for us, you see. You will recall in the NLB we were able to do this. Do you remember that in the identification of members of the board in that particular case? And it will be very helpful to us to see these are the areas, these are the clauses related to these areas, and how do we go forward on here? What are the challenges we're facing? It also means reordering and categorizing all these inputs we've received. And if we look at that, it amounts to three huge files. That's a huge amount of work. By comparison, the company's amendment bill is small in terms of the volume, you know, of work. So that has to be done. So certainly we have to, according to our own commitment, try and complete the company's amendment bill before the end of the financial year, because it does impact on Cipro and that situation. And I think we took a decision halfway last year that we cannot allow that to continue and continue. We need to address that, and we need the company's amendment bill to do that. So our priority will be to proceed on this, on the company's amendment bill. The second thing will be to factor in the intellectual property and see where we can take that. The third thing, of course, is to remember that we do have the State of Nation, and we will have our own budget, the budget being tabled. So all those issues will have to come into play. One thing is clear, we're going to need a one-day workshop in respect of the strategic review. So I've asked the committee secretary to draw up a draft program to submit it to you as soon as he can. It will be a first draft, and for you to convey your comments directly to him by email. You're well aware of how to do this. So that when he comes to me and the Manco, we're able to take a position and decision on that. I can't give you dates other than saying on the 18th, I think, we're having the task team for the company's amendment bill. That is the beginning of committees. And I just want to clarify who's sitting on that task team. I'm heading that task team. I thought you were there, Honourable Coetzee. I can't remember. Are you sitting on the company's amendment bill? Yes. So many of them, yes. Who else is sitting on that? DA, who's sitting on that? You must, I think Smiley's been there, but so have you, Honourable Harris. You must give us a position so the committee secretary knows with whom to, you know, communicate. Let me leave that to yourself. Honourable Alberts, you were working on the intellectual property, so I'm not sure if you feel, well, look, that'll, your hands are now tied, as it were. I know, Honourable Kwabasi, you were working as well on the intellectual property. So, again, I don't want to pressurise members, but we do need the DA on board, as you know. We also need, of course, did you say the Freedom Front could be interested there? Right. So we've got that, and then Honourable Kwabasa, I cannot ask the Honourable September to come on board here. She's already leading a task team. Honourable Khadebe, you know, to put the whip and the chair together, usually we may want to alternate if we've got double commitments, but certainly he's going to be very welcome. So let me leave it, not debate the issue. I think within the ANC itself, a position will be taken. Am I right, Honourable Kwabasa? And you'll come back to the secretary and myself on that. Having said that, I don't think there's anything more for me to say, but is Honourable Smiley going to deal with that one? Right. Can I just say that I appreciate your commitments today, for example, I really do. And I would like to wish you all well over the festive season, but also a very hard-working constituency period. But I think it becomes very important for you to take a break with your families. And if it's, you know, we all have families of one kind or another, and we really need to spend time with them. It's going to be an incredibly busy first term. I think we all, not term, but session. Because it'll be followed by local government elections. And then there's, before that, it's Easter, somewhere around there. State of Nation, the budget. You know, it's going to be jam-packed. So my appeal to you is to spend some time with your families, to travel safely, to the staff here, the content specialist, thank you for your dedication, the committee secretary, all the hard work you're putting in, hope it's left you time to complete the masters, the researcher, the new researcher, Mr. Zabili, I hope you've put your manager quite clear as to where your priority is. It's DTI, then all the other little things, yeah, all the big things. And then our, you see, our systems seem to change all the time, as you know. We seem to have had, how many this year? 6 of them altogether. But certainly, you've been with us a long time. Is it Gunther? I can't, as I wasn't too sure if it could be Gunther. Is it Gunther? Yes, thank you very much. A special thanks to everyone here, the also the Parliamentary Liaison Officer, who's here as frequently as she can be. From myself, thank you. Thank you for your commitment. And try to enjoy some time with your families. Thank you.